the fold speaks the revelatory tongue, the Chotet language, perfectly. No accent, no gaps in vocabulary. You cannot speak the Chotet language that way, so innately, without having Chotet blood, without belonging to us, in a more significant way. And I have seen that demonstrated.
In what way? Vec asked.
As he lifted his glass to his lips, I spotted his rings, one for each finger, each one smooth and otherwise undecorated. I wondered why he even wore them. My servant has shown himself to be a natural Chotet, I said. A good fighter, with a good eye for what makes our people distinct. His ability to adapt to our culture is shocking.
Surely a sign of what I was telling you, sir, Ema chimed in, that there is evidence of a cultural, historical memory in Chotet blood that ensures that all so-called kidnapped people, people with the gift of Chotet language, who make it to our land, find true belonging there. She was so good at pretending to be devoted.
Well, Vec said, that is an interesting theory.
We must also account for the past crimes of one of the, shall we say, more influential planets in the galaxy, against our people. Invasion of our territory, kidnapping of our children, violence toward, sometimes even the murder of, our citizens.
Rizek's brow furrowed as if the mere thought pained him.
Certainly, this is not the fault of Pitha, to which we have always been kindly disposed. But reparations are certainly in order, from Thuva particularly. Yet I have heard rumors that the Chotet are responsible for the death of one of Thuva's oracles and the kidnapping of another, Vec replied, tapping his rings together as he spoke.
Unfounded, Rizek replied.
As to the reason the oldest Thuvazit oracle took her own life, we can't know it. We don't know the reasons for anything the oracles do we?
He was appealing to Vex Pithar practicality. The oracles held no importance here. They were just madmen shouting over the waves. Vec tapped his fingers against the glass in his other hand.
Yes, perhaps we can discuss your proposition further, Vec said reluctantly. There may be room for cooperation between our planet and your nation.
Nation, Rizek said with a smile. Yes, that is all we ask to be called. An independent nation, capable of determining its own future.
Excuse me, I said, touching Rizek's arm lightly. I hoped it stung. I'm going to find another drink.
Of course, Rizek said to me.
As I turned away, I heard him say to Vec,
her current gift gives her constant pain, you know. We are always looking for solutions to improve her functioning. Some days are better than others.
Gritting my teeth, I kept marching until I was too far away to hear him. I felt like I might be sick. We had come to Pithar because of their advanced weaponry, because Rizek wanted an alliance. I had just, in some way, helped him make one. And I knew what Rizek wanted weapons for, to use against Thuva, not to become an independent nation, as he would have Vec believe. How could I face Akos now, knowing I had helped my brother move toward war against his home? I didn't look for him. I heard a deep rumble, like thunder. First I thought we were, impossibly, hearing the sounds of the storm through the stretch of water that separated us from the surface. Then I saw, through gaps in the crowd, a line of musicians at the front of the room. The overhead lights dimmed everywhere but above their heads. Each of them sat behind a low table, and on each table was one of the intricate instruments I had pointed out to Akos at the Chotet Market. But these were much larger and more complex than the one we had seen. They glinted in the low light, waist high, their iridescent panes half as wide as my palm. A harsh crack followed the rumble of thunder. With that, the other musicians began to play, bringing in the tinkling sounds of light rain, the deeper thrum of thicker droplets. The others played the crashing waves, the lapping of water against a non-existent shore. All around us were the sounds of water, dripping from faucets, gushing from waterfalls. A Pithar woman with black hair standing to my right closed her eyes, swaying on the spot. Without meaning to, I found Akos in the crowd, still holding two glasses, both now empty. He smiled a little. "I have to get you out of here," I thought, as if he could hear me. "And I will."
Chapter 21. Akos. In a cold, blank room in Pitha's capital, Akos gave up on sleep. He and Syra had never slept without a door between them before, so Akos hadn't known that she ground her teeth, or that she dreamt all the time, moaning and muttering. He'd spent most of the night with his eyes open, waiting for her to settle, only it never happened. He was still too sore to get comfortable anyway. He had never been in a room so bare. Gray floors gave way to pale walls. The beds had white sheets and no frames. At least there was a window. In the early morning hours, as light came back to the world, he could just barely make out a maze of scaffolding underwater. Green slime and supple yellow vines wrapped around it, holding up the city. Well, that was something the Pithar and the Thuvazit had in common, he thought. They lived in places that ought not to exist. In those early hours, Akos was swallowed up in the question that wouldn't leave him be. Why hadn't he pulled away when Syra kissed him? It wasn't like she had surprised him. She had leaned in, slow, her hand warm on his chest and pressing, almost like she was pushing him away. But he hadn't moved a muscle. He'd gone over it in his mind again and again. "Maybe," he thought as he stuck his head under the bathroom faucet to wet his hair, "I even liked it." But he was scared to even entertain the notion. It meant the fate that worried at him, the fate that tugged at the strings connecting his heart to Thuva and home, was suddenly Izzet's away from his face. "You're quiet," Syra said as they made their way to the landing bay side by side. "Did that engine grease you drank last night get to you?" "No," he said. Somehow it felt wrong to tease her about talking in her sleep when he knew the kinds of things that likely haunted her. No trifles there. "Just new place, that's all." "Right. Well, I keep burping up sour, so..." She pulled a face. "I am not enamored with Pitha, I have to say. Except..." He started, about to add something about the concert the night before. She interrupted him with, "The music. Yes." His knuckles brushed hers. He jerked away. He was too aware of every touch now, even though Syra had promised she wouldn't make another move, and hadn't talked about it since. They reached the breezeway. Not the word Akos would have picked, but there was a sign over the doorway saying what it was, where some of the others were putting on waterproof jumpsuits and boots. Rizek, Ima, Vas, Suzau, and Aija weren't there, but Vakrez and Malin were, Malin sorting through boots to find the right size. He was a small, thin man, with a beard that was just a shadow under his jaw, and bright eyes. An unequal match for Vakrez, the cold military commander who had seen to Akos's Shotet education. "Syra," Malin said, nodding as Vakrez eyed Akos. Akos stood up straighter, lifting his chin. He could still hear Vakrez's relentless voice scolding him for slouching, for dragging his feet, for uttering so much as a curse in Thuvazit. "Kereseth," Vakrez said, "you look bigger." "That's because I actually feed him, unlike your barracks kitchen." Syra thrust a bright green jumpsuit into Akos's arms that was marked L. When he unfolded it, it looked nearly as wide as it was tall, but no reason to complain as long as he didn't get water in his boots.
"Right you are," Malin said in his reedy voice.
"You used to eat there without complaining," Vakres said, elbowing him.
"Only because I was trying to get you to notice me," Malin said.
"Notice I haven't been back there since." Akos watched Syra put on her suit to see how she did it. It looked so easy for her that he wondered if she'd been to Pitha before. But he felt awed asking her questions, acting at all normal, with Vakres right there. She stepped into the suit and pulled straps he hadn't noticed before tight around her ankles, binding the fabric to her body. She did the same with hidden straps at her wrists, then fastened the suit up to her throat. Hers was as shapeless as his own, built for a person not made spare by the hard life of a Shotet.
"We were planning to join one of the platoons for the scavenge," Vakra said to Syra. "But if you prefer that we go out on a separate vessel..."
"No," Syra said. "I'd rather try to blend in with your soldiers."
No thank you, no niceties. It was Syra's way.
Once they were all in suits and strapped into their boots, they walked the covered tunnel to a ship, not the one they'd flown in the day before, but a smaller floater, round with a domed roof so the water would slide off as it flew. Soon enough they were drifting above the waves, which looked like snowdrifts to Akos at a squint. They had the same captain they'd had yesterday. Rel was his name. And he pointed out where they were headed, a huge island about the size of a city sector, piled up high with scrap. The Pithar kept their refuse afloat. At a distance, the trash pile looked like a brown-gray lump, but once they got closer, he saw the pieces that made it up. Huge sheets of twisted metal, old rusty girders with pins and screws still stuck in them. Soaked fabric of all different colors, cracked glass as thick as his hand. Clustered between some of the larger piles was Vakrez's platoon, all wearing the same color suits they had on. They touched down behind the platoon and filed out of the floater one by one, Rel at the back. The drum of the rain on the roof gave way to its splatter on the ground. The drops were heavy, each one a hard tap on Akos's head and shoulders and arms. He could feel only their temperature on his cheeks, warm, which was unexpected. Someone at the head of the platoon was talking.
"Your job is to spot things that are actually valuable. Newer current motors and engines, intact scrap metal, broken or discarded weapons. Do not cause trouble. And if you see any native observers, be courteous and show them to either me or Commander Noavec, who has just joined us. Welcome, sir."
Vakrez nodded to him and added, "Remember, the reputation of your sovereign and of Shotet itself is at stake here. They see us as barbaric and ignorant. You must behave as if that is not the case." A few of the soldiers laughed like they weren't sure they ought to, since Vakrez wasn't smiling even a little. Akos wasn't sure the commander's face remembered how to do it.
"Get to it!"
A few soldiers surged ahead to climb the pile right in front of them, made up of floater parts. Akos searched the ones who dawdled behind for faces he knew from training, but it was hard to tell. They wore head coverings that looked almost like helmets, and visors to protect their eyes from the rain. He and Syra didn't have them. He kept blinking raindrops into his eyes.
"Helmets," Malin said. "I knew we forgot something. Would you like me to request that one of the soldiers give you theirs, Syra?"
"No," Syra said, almost snapping. "No, thank you."
"You know of X," Malin said. "How is it that simple words like please and thank you sound so unnatural coming from you?"
"Must be in the blood," Syra said. "Come on, Akos. I think I see something useful." She put her hand in his like it was natural. And maybe it should have been, just him relieving her pain, like he was supposed to. But after the way she had touched him in her room on the sojourn ship, fervently, reverently. After that, how could he possibly lay a casual hand on her again? All he could think about was how hard he was squeezing. Too hard? Not hard enough? They walked between two piles of floater pieces, toward a stretch of scrap metal, some of it warm in color, like sun-kissed skin. Akos walked to the edge of the island where huge girders kept the shape of the man-made land. He wasn't looking for weapons or scrap or machines. He was looking for small things that would tell stories. Broken toys, old shoes, kitchen utensils. Syra crouched next to a bent pole, scraped at the base like it had been the casualty of a collision. When she tugged at it, it just kept coming, knocking over empty cans and cracked pipes. At the end of the pole, now twice as long as Akos was tall, was a tattered flag with a gray background and a circle of symbols in its center. "Look at this," she said to him, smiling. "This is their old flag before their acceptance into the Assembly of Nine Planets. It's at least 30 seasons old. How is it not disintegrated in the rain?" he asked, pinching the frayed corner. "Pitha specializes in durable materials. Glass that doesn't erode, metal that doesn't rust, fabric that doesn't tear," she said. "Buoyant platforms that can carry whole cities." "Not fishing line?" She shook her head. "Not many fish near enough to the surface for traditional fishing. Deep sea crafts do some of the work. One fish can feed an entire town, I've heard. Do you always make a point to know so much about places you hate?" "As I told you yesterday," she said. "No friends. Too much time. Let's find more slimy relics of the past, shall we?" He hunted along the edge of the island, searching for... well, nothing in particular, really. After a while, everything started to look the same. The dull metal just as useful as the shiny stuff. All the fabric blurring into the same color. Near the far edge, he saw a half-rotten bird skeleton. It had webbed feet, a swimmer then, and a beak with a wicked curve. He heard a shout behind him and whipped around to make sure Syra was okay, his bruised ribs protesting. He saw a flash of teeth. She was grinning, calling for one of the others. When he went back to her, he expected to see something shiny, something useful-looking. But it was just more metal, gray in color, dull. "What the?" "Commander Noavek," said the soldier who had come to Cyrus' side first, her eyes wide behind the rain-streaked visor. Vakres jogged over. "I saw a corner of it peeking out and dug deeper," Cyrus said excitedly. "It's a big piece, I think." He could tell what she meant. The corner of whatever she had found was thick, and back in the pile of junk were glints of the same shade. It looked like the sheet was as tall as the flagpole had been. He didn't understand why they were so excited about it. "Miss Novik," he said to her. "It's Pitha's most valuable substance," she said in response, tugging wet fabric away from the metal. "Agneto. Strong enough to withstand heavy hits from things like asteroids. Holds up well when we pass through the current stream. For the past 10 seasons, it's the only thing we've been using to repair the Sojourn ship, but it's a rare find." Half the platoon had come running, and now everyone was helping Syra unearth the sheet, most grinning just like she was. Akko stood back as they dug deeper, finally loosing enough of the sheet to get a good grip. Together they dragged it from the rubble, then carried it back to the transport vessel, which had a hold under it big enough to carry the Agneto. He didn't know what to make of seeing them all work together, Syra and Vakres Noavek right there with common soldiers, like they weren't royalty. Syra with that look she sometimes wore when they made ice flower blends together and she got something right at last. A kind of pride, he thought, in doing something useful. It was a good look for her. As a kid, he dreamt of going off-planet. All the kids in Hessa had, because Hessa kids were mostly too poor to ever leave. The Kerseth family was richer than most in Hessa, but they had nothing compared to farm owners in Shissa or Ozok up north. Still, his dad had promised him that someday he would take him into space, and they could visit another planet, Akos's choice. The water planet hadn't been his first choice, or even his second. Nobody in Thuva knew how to swim, because pretty much all the water they had came in the form of ice. But now he had been to Pitha. He had been in earshot of the pounding waves, had seen the frothy surface from above, had felt his own smallness as he stood on the landing pad with water in every direction, warm rain pounding on his head. Then, almost as soon as he was starting to get used to it, they were gone. He was dripping water on the floor of the floater, holding a vial of rainwater. Syra had given it to him as they loaded the Agnato into the transport. "You may as well have a memento of your first time on another planet," she'd said with a shrug, like it meant nothing. Only there wasn't much that meant nothing to Syra, Akos was finding. At first, he hadn't seen the point of a memento, because who would he show it to? He wouldn't be seeing his family again. He was going to die among the Shotet. But he had to have hope for his brother, at least. Maybe Ijah could take it home with him after Jorik got him out. Syra had two fistfuls of old flag in her lap, and though she wasn't smiling, she had a fierce energy in her face from finding the Agnato. "I take it you did a good thing," Akos said, when he was sure Vakres and Malin weren't listening. "Yeah," she nodded once. "Yeah, I did." After a tick, she added, "I guess it was bound to happen eventually. I was due." "Your current shadows aren't as dark," he said, leaning his head back. She was quiet then, staring at the streaks of darkness, now more gray than black, that coursed over her palm, all the way back to the Sojourn ship. They made it back in good time. All of them soaked through. Some of the other ships had come back from the scavenge early, so there were people in wet clothes milling around everywhere, trading stories. Everybody peeled the, supposedly, waterproof suits off their bodies and dumped them in piles to be cleaned. "So the Shotet just have a bunch of waterproof clothes lying around?" he said to Syra as they walked back to their quarters. "We've been to Pitha before," she said. "Every sovereign has researchers who prepare for every planet in advance. But anyone over a certain age knows how to survive in any environment, essentially. Desert, mountain, ocean, marsh." "Desert," he said. "I can't even imagine walking on hot sand." "Maybe someday you will," she said. His smile fell away. She was right, probably. How many sojourns would he go on before he died for her family? 2? 3? 20? How many worlds would he walk on? "That's not what I..." she started. She paused. "Life is long, Akos." "But the fates are certain," he said, echoing his mother. Few fates seemed more certain than his, either. Death, service, the family Noavik. It was clear enough. Cyrus stopped. They were near the public training room where the air smelled like old shoes and sweat. She wrapped her hand around his wrist and held tight. "If I helped you get out right now," she said, "would you go?" His heart pounded hard. "What are you talking about?" "The loading bay is chaos," Cyrus said, leaning closer. Her eyes were very dark, he realized, almost black. And lively, too, like the pain that racked her body also gave her energy to spare. "The doors open every few minutes to let a new ship in. You think they'd be able to stop you if you stole a floater right now? You could be home in days." Home in days. Akos took in the memory of the place like it was a familiar smell. Sisi, soothing with her smile alone. His mom teasing them with prophetic riddles. Their little warm kitchen with the red burnstone lamp. The sea of feathergrass that grew right up against the house. The tufts brushing the windows. The creaky staircase that went up to the room he shared with... "No," he said, shaking his head. Not without Aja.
That's what I thought, Cyrus said sadly as she let go of him. She gnawed on her lip, trouble in her eyes. They went all the way to her quarters without talking, and when she got there, she went right into the bathroom to change into dry clothes.
Akos parked himself in front of the newsfeed, out of habit. Usually Thuva was only mentioned in the stream of words at the bottom of the feed, and even then, Syra told him, the news was only about ice flower output. Ice flowers were the only thing the other planets really cared about when it came to their cold planet, since they were used in so many medicines. But today the live footage showed a giant snowdrift. He knew the place. Ozok, the northernmost city of Thuva, frozen and white. The buildings there floated in the sky like clouds made of glass, held up by some technology from Othir he didn't understand. They were shaped like raindrops, like wilting petals, coming to points at either end. They had gone there to see his cousins one year, wrapped up in their warmest clothes, and stayed in their apartment building which hung in the sky like ripe fruit that would never fall. Ice flowers still grew that far north, but they were far, far below, just colored smudges from that distance. Akos sat on the edge of Cyrus' bed, wetting the sheets with his damp clothes. It was hard for him to breathe. Ozok. Ozok. Ozok, was the chant in his mind. White flakes on the wind, frost patterns on the windows, ice flower stems brittle enough to break at a touch. What is it? Syra was braiding her hair away from her face. Her hands fell when she saw the screen. She read the subtitle aloud. Faded Chancellor of Thuva steps forward. Akos tapped the screen to turn up the volume. In Othirian, the voice muttered. She promises a strong stand against Rizek Noavek on behalf of the oracles of Thuva, lost 2 seasons ago, allegedly in a Shotet invasion on Thuvazit soil.
Your chancellor isn't elected? Syra asked.
Isn't that why they use the word chancellor instead of sovereign, because the position is elected rather than inherited?
Thuvazit chancellors are fated, elected by the current, they say.
We say, he said. If she noticed his slip from we to they, she didn't mention it. Some generations there is no chancellor and we just have regional representatives. Those are elected.
Ah.
Syra turned toward the screen, watching beside him. There was a crowd on the landing platform, bundled though it was covered. A ship was perched at the edge, and the hatch was opening. As a dark-clothed woman stepped down, the crowd burst into cheers. The sights swooped in close, showing her face, wrapped in a scarf that covered her nose and mouth. But her eyes were dark, with a hint of lighter gray around the pupil. The sights were very close, buzzing like flies across her face, and gently sloped. And he knew her. He knew her.
Ori, he said, breathless. Right behind her was another woman, just as tall, just as slim, and just as covered. When the sights shifted to her, Akos saw that the women were the same, practically down to the eyelash, not just sisters, but twins. Ori had a sister. Ori had a double. Akos searched their faces for a hint of difference and found none.
You know them, Cyrus said softly. For a tick, all he could do was nod. Then he wondered if he ought to have. Ori had only gone by Orieva Rednalis, not a name that was supposed to belong to a fate-favored child, because her real identity was dangerous, which meant it would be better to keep it to himself. But, he thought as he looked up at Syra, and he didn't finish the thought, he just let the words tumble out. She was a friend of our family when I was a child, when she was a child. She went by an alias. I didn't know she had a sister. Ise and Orieva Benazit, Syra said, reading the names from the screen. The twins were walking into a building. They both looked graceful, with the breeze from inside the building pressing their coats, buttoned at the side, at the shoulder, tight to their bodies. He didn't recognize the fur of their scarves or the fabric of the coats themselves, black and clear of snow even now, an off-world material to be sure. Rednalis is the name she used, he said. A Hesse name. The day the fates were announced was the last time I saw her. Ise and Orieva stopped to greet people on the way in, but as they walked away and the sights peered after them, he saw a flash of movement. The second sister hooked her arm around the first sister's neck, drawing her head in close, the same way Ori had done with Aija when she wanted to whisper something in his ear. Then Akos couldn't see much anymore because his eyes were full of tears. That was Ori, who had a space at his family table, who had known him before he became this armored, vengeful, life-taking thing. My country has a chancellor, he said. Congratulations, Syra said. Hesitantly, she asked, why did you tell me all that? It's probably not something you should broadcast here. Her alias, how you know her, all that. Akos blinked his eyes clear. I don't know. Maybe I trust you. She lifted her hand and hesitated with it over his shoulder. Then she lowered it, touching him lightly. They watched the screen side by side. I would never keep you here. You know that, right? She was so quiet. He'd never heard her that quiet. Not anymore. If you wanted to go, I would help you go. Akos covered her hand with his own, just a light touch, but it was charged with new energy, like an ache he didn't quite mind. When I get Aija out, he said, would you ever go with me? You know, I think I would, she sighed. But only if Rizek was dead. As the ship turned back toward home, news of Rizek's success on Pitha came toward them in pieces. Otega was the source of most of Syra's gossip, Akos found, and she had a good read on things before they were even announced. The Sovereign is pleased, Otega said, dropping off a pot of soup one night. I think he made an alliance between a historically fate-faithful nation like Shotet and a secular planet like Pitha. That's no small feat. Then she had given Akos a curious look. Kariseth, I presume. Syra didn't say you were so... She paused. Syra's eyebrows popped up like they were on springs. She was leaning against the wall, arms folded, chewing on a lock of hair. Sometimes she stuck it in her mouth without noticing. Then she'd spit it out, with a look of surprise, like it had crept into her mouth on its own. Tall, Otega finished. Akos wondered what word she would have chosen if she felt comfortable being honest. Not sure why she would have to mention that, Akos replied. It was easy to be comfortable around Otega. He slid into it without thinking much about it. She's tall too, after all. Yes, quite tall, the lot of you, Otega said distantly. Well, enjoy that soup. When she left, Syra went straight to the news feed to translate the Shotet subtitles for him. This time, it was startling how different they were. The Shotet words apparently said, Pithar Chancellor opens up friendly support negotiations in light of Shotet visit to Pithar capital. But the Otherian voice said, Thuvizit Chancellor Benazit threatens Iceflower trade embargoes against Pitha in wake of their tentative aid discussions with Shotet leadership. Apparently your chancellor isn't pleased that Rizek charmed the Pithar, Syra remarked. Threatening trade embargoes and all. Well, Akos said, Rizek is trying to conquer her. Syra grunted. That translation doesn't have Malin's flair. They must have used someone else. Malin likes to spin information, not leave it out entirely. Akos almost laughed. You can tell who it is by the translation?
There is an art to Noavec bullshit, Cyrus said as she muted the feed. We're taught it from birth.
Their quarters, Akos had started to think of them that way, much as it unsettled him, were the eye of the storm, quiet and settled in the midst of chaos. Everybody was getting everything in order for landing. He couldn't believe the sojourn was coming to a close. He felt like they had just taken off. And then, on the day the current stream lost its last blue streaks, he knew it was time to make good on his promise to Drorik.
You sure he won't just turn me in to Rizek for drugging him?
Akos said to Syra. Suzao is a soldier at heart, Syra said, for what had to be the 100th time. She turned the page in her book.
He prefers to settle things himself. Turning you in would be the maneuver of a coward.
With that, Akos set out for the cafeteria. He was aware of his hurried heartbeat, his twitchy fingers. This time of week, Suzao ate in one of the lower cafeterias. He was one of the lowest ranked of Rizek's close supporters, which meant he was the least important person most places he went. But in the lower cafeterias, near the ship's chugging machinery, he got to be superior for once. It was the perfect place to provoke him. He couldn't very well be shamed by a servant in front of his inferiors, could he? Drorik had promised to help with the last move. He was ahead of his father in line when Akos walked into the cafeteria, a big, dank room on one of the lowest decks of the ship. It was cramped and smoky, but the smell on the air was spiced and rich and made his mouth water. At a nearby table, a group of Shotet younger than him had pushed their trays aside and were playing a game with machines small enough to fit in Akos's palm. They were collections of gears and wires balanced on wheels, one with a big set of pincers fixed to its nose, another with a blade, a third with a thumb-sized hammer. They had drawn a circle on the table with chalk, and inside it, the machines stalked each other, controlled by remotes. As they collided, bystanders shouted advice.
Go for the right wheel! Use the pincers! What else are they for?
They wore odd clothes in blue, green, and purple, bare arms wrapped in cords of different colors, hair shaved and braided and piled high. A sweep of feeling overtook him as he watched, an image of himself as a Shotet child, holding a remote, or just braced against the table, watching. It had never been, would never be. But for just a tick, it seemed like it could have been possible. He turned to the pile of trays near the food line and picked one up. He had a small vial buried in his fist, and he slipped ahead in line, edging closer to Suzao so he could dose the other man's cup. Right on time, Jorik stumbled into the person ahead of him, dropping his tray with a clatter. Soup hit the woman ahead of him right between the shoulders, and she swore. In the commotion, Akos dumped the elixir in Suzao's cup without anyone noticing. He passed Jorik while he was helping the soup-stained woman clean up. She was elbowing him away, cursing. When Suzao sat down at his usual table and drank from his tainted cup, Akos stopped to take a breath. Suzao had barged into his house along with the others. He'd stood there and watched as Vas murdered Akos's father. His fingerprints were on the walls of Akos's home, his footprints on the floor. Akos's safest place marked up and down with violence. The memories, as crisp as ever, steeled Akos for what he needed to do. He put his tray down across from Suzao, whose eyes ran up his arm like a skimming hand, counting the kill marks there.
Remember me? Akos said.
Suzao was smaller than him now, but so brawn through the shoulders it didn't seem that way when he was sitting. His nose was spotted with freckles. He didn't look much like Jorik, who took after his mother. Good thing, too.
The pathetic child I dragged across the divide, Suzao said, biting down on the tines of his fork, and then beat to a pulp before we even made it to the transport vessels. Yeah, I remember. Now get your tray off my table.
Akos sat, folding his hands in front of him. A rush of adrenaline had given him pinhole vision, and Suzao was in the very center.
How are you feeling? A little sleepy? He said as he slammed the vial down in front of him. The glass cracked, but the vial stayed in one piece, still wet from the sleeping potion he had poured in Cezao's cup. Silence spread through the cafeteria, starting at their table. Cezao stared at the vial. His face got blotchier with every second. His eyes were glassy with rage. Akos leaned closer, smiling. Your living quarters aren't as secure as you'd probably like. What is this? The third time you've been drugged in the past month? Not very vigilant, are you? Cezao lunged, grabbed him by the throat, lifted and slammed him hard into the table right on top of his tray of food. Soup burned Akos through his shirt. Cezao drew his knife and held the point over Akos's head like he was going to shove it in Akos's eye. Akos saw spots. I should kill you, Cezao snarled, flecks of spit dotting his lips. Go ahead, he said, straining. But maybe you should wait until you're not about to fall over. Sure enough, Cezao looked a little unfocused. He let go of Akos's throat. Fine, he said. Then I challenge you to the arena. Blades. To the death. The man didn't disappoint. Akos sat up, slowly, making a show of his trembling hands, his food-stained shirt. Syra had told him to make sure Cezao underestimated him before they made it to the arena, if he could. He wiped the spit flecks from his cheek and nodded. I accept, Akos said, and drawn by some kind of magnetism, his eyes found Jorek, who looked relieved.
Chapter 22. Syra. The renegades didn't pass me a message in the cafeteria, or whisper one in my ear as I walked across the Sojourn ship. They didn't hack into my personal screens or cause a disruption and kidnap me. A few days after the scavenge, I was walking back to my quarters, and I saw blonde hair swinging ahead of me, Tekka, holding a dirty rag in grease-streaked fingers. She glanced back at me, beckoning me with a curled finger, and I followed her. She led me not to a secret room or passageway, but to the loading bay. It was dark there, and the silhouettes of transport vessels looked like huge creatures huddled in sleep. In a far corner, someone had left a light on, attached to the wing of one of the biggest transport vessels. If rain and thunder were music to the Pithar, the churn of machinery was music to the Shotet. It was the sound of the Sojourn ship, the sound of our movement side by side with the current stream. So it made sense that in this part of the ship, where their conversation would be buried by the hum and thrum of machinery on the level below us, was a small, shabby gathering of renegades. They were all dressed in the jumpsuits that maintenance workers wore. Maybe they were all actually maintenance workers, now that I thought about it. And they had covered their faces with the same black mask Tekka had worn when she attacked me in the hallway. Tekka drew a knife and held the blade against my throat. It was cold and smelled sweet, not unlike some of Akos's mixtures. Move any closer to them and I will knock you out cold, Tekka said. Tell me this isn't your whole membership. In my mind, I ran through what I could do to free myself, beginning with stomping on her toes. Would we risk you exposing our entire membership to your brother? Tekka said. No. The light clipped to the wing of the transport ship lost one of its metal bindings and swayed on its cord, dangling now from only one fastener.
You're the one who wanted to meet, one of the others said.
He sounded older, gruffer. He was a boulder of a man, with a beard thick enough for things to get lost in.
What did you want, exactly?
I forced myself to swallow. Tekka's knife was still at my throat, but that wasn't what was making it hard to speak. It was finally articulating what I had been thinking for months. It was finally doing something instead of just thinking about it, for the first time in my life. I want safe transport out of Shotet for someone, I said. Someone who doesn't exactly want to leave.
For someone?
the one who had spoken earlier said.
Who?
Akos Karaseth, I said. There were mutters.
He doesn't want to leave? Then why do you want to get him out?
The man said. It's complicated, I said. His brother is here. His brother is also lost, beyond hope of recovery. I paused. Some people are fools for love.
Ah, Tekka whispered. I see how it is.
I felt like they were all laughing at me, smiling under their dark masks. I didn't like it. I grabbed Tekka's wrist and twisted hard so she couldn't point the knife at me. She groaned at my touch, and I pinched the flat of the blade between my fingers, pulling it free. I flipped it in one hand so I was gripping the handle, my fingers slippery with whatever had been painted on the blade. Before Tekka could recover, I lunged, pinning her against my chest by the arm and pointing the knife at her side. I tried to keep as much of the current gift pain to myself as I could, gritting my teeth so I wouldn't scream. I was breathing hard right next to her ear. She was still. I may be a fool, too, I said, but I am not stupid. You think I can't identify you by the way you stand, the way you walk, the way you speak? If I'm going to betray you, I will do it whether you wear masks and hold me at knife point or not. And we all know that I can't betray you without betraying myself. So, I blew a strand of Tekka's hair away from my mouth. Are we going to have this discussion with mutual trust or not? I released Tekka and offered her the knife. She was glaring at me, clutching her wrist, but she took it.
All right, the man said.
He undid the covering that shielded his mouth. Beneath it, his thick beard crept down to his throat. Some of the others followed suit. Jorek was one of them, standing off to my right with his arms crossed. Unsurprising, since he had so baldly requested his Noavek loyal father's death in the arena. Others didn't bother, but it didn't matter. It was their spokesman I had cared about.
I'm Tos, and I think we can do what you ask, the man said. And I think you're aware that we would require something else in return.
What is it you'd like me to do? I said.
We need your help getting into Noavek Manor.
Tos crossed his thick arms. His clothes were made of off-planet fabrics, too lightweight for the Shotet cold.
In Voa, after the sojourn.
Are you an exile? I said, frowning at him. That's off-worlder garb you're wearing. Were the renegades in contact with the exiles, who had sought safety from the Noavek regime on another planet? It made sense, but I hadn't considered the ramifications before. The exiles were undoubtedly a more powerful force than the rebellious Shotet who had turned against my brother, and more dangerous to me, personally.
For our intents and purposes, there is no difference between exile and renegade. We both want the same thing, to unseat your brother and restore Shotet society to what it was before your family soiled it with inequity,
Tos replied. Soiled it with inequity, I repeated. An elegant turn of phrase.
I wasn't the one who devised it, Tos said humorlessly.
To put it less elegantly, Tekka said, you're starving us and hoarding medicine. Not to mention carving out our eyeballs, or whatever else gets Rizek's blood pumping these days.
I was about to protest that I had never starved anyone, or kept them from adequate medical care, but suddenly it didn't seem worth arguing. I didn't truly believe it anyway.
Right.
So, Noavek Manor. What do you intend to do there? It was the only building that I, specifically, could help someone access. I knew all the codes Rizek liked to use, and beyond that, the most secure doors were locked with a gene code, part of the system Rizek had installed after our parents died. I was the only one left who shared Rizek's genes. My blood could get them wherever they wanted to go.
I don't think you need to know that information.
I furrowed my brow. There were only a few things a group of renegades, or exiles, could want inside Noavec Manor. I decided to make an assumption.
Let's be clear, I said. You're asking me to participate in the assassination of my brother.
Does that bother you?
Tos said. No, I replied. Not anymore. Despite all that Rizek had done to me, I was surprised by how easily the answer came to me. He was my brother, my very blood. He was also the only guarantee of safety I currently had. Any renegades who overthrew him would not care to spare the life of his sister, the murderer. But somewhere between ordering me to participate in Zosita's interrogation and threatening Akos, Rizek had finally lost any loyalty I had left.
Good, Tos said. Then we'll be in touch.
Rearranging my skirt around my crossed legs, I searched the crowded hall that evening for Suzao Kuzar's regiment. They were all there, lined up along the balcony, exchanging giddy looks. Good, I thought. They were overconfident, which meant Suzao was also overconfident, and more easily defeated. The room was humming with chatter, not quite as full as it had been when I fought Letty a few months before, but a much larger crowd than most reclaimed challengers would ever hope to attract. That was also good. Winning an arena challenge could always give someone higher social status technically, but for it to really matter, everyone in Shotet society had to mutually agree on it. The more people who watched Akos defeat Suzao, the better his perceived status would be, which made it easier for him to get Aija out. Power in one place tended to transfer to power elsewhere. Power over the right people. Rizek had stayed away from tonight's challenge, but Voss joined me on the platform reserved for high-ranking Shotet officials. I sat on one side of it, and he sat on the other. In dark spaces, it was easier for me to avoid stares, with my current gift buried in shadow. But I couldn't hide it from Voss, who was close enough to see my skin flush with dark tendrils every time I heard Akos's name spoken in the crowd.
You know, I didn't tell Rizek about how you spoke to Zosita's daughter on the loading bay before the scavenge,
Voss said to me, in the moments before Suzao entered the arena. My heart began to pound. I felt like the renegade meeting was marked on me, visible to anyone who looked carefully enough. But I tried to stay calm as I replied, Last time I checked, it wasn't against Rizek's rules to speak to maintenance workers.
Maybe he wouldn't have cared before, but he certainly does now.
Am I supposed to thank you for your discretion?
No. You're supposed to treat this like a second chance. Make sure all this foolishness has just been a momentary lapse, Syra.
I turned back to the arena. The lights lowered, and the speakers squealed as someone turned on the enhancers that dangled over the fighters, amplifying sound. Suzao entered first, to the screams and cheers of the crowd. He lifted his arms to inspire more screaming, and the gesture did its job. Everyone erupted. Arrogant, I muttered. Not because of what he had done, but because of what he was wearing. He had left his Shotet armor behind, so he was in just a shirt. He didn't believe he needed armor. But he hadn't seen Akos fight in a long time. Akos entered the arena a moment later, wearing the armor he had earned and the boots he had worn on Pitha, which were sturdy. He was greeted with jeers and obscene gestures, but they didn't seem to reach him, wherever he really was. Even the wariness that was always in his eyes was gone. Suzao drew his knife, and Akos's stare suddenly hardened, like he had made a decision. He drew his own knife. I knew which one it was. It was the blade I had given him, the plain knife from Zold. At his touch, no current tendrils wrapped around the blade. to the crowd, so used to seeing people fight with current blades instead of plain knives, I was sure it was as if the knife was wrapped in the hand of a corpse. All the whispers about him, about his resistance to the current, were now confirmed. All the better, for his gift to frighten them. Fearsomeness gave a person a different kind of power. I would know. Suzhou tossed his knife back and forth, spinning it on his palms as he did. It was a trick he had to have learned from his Zivatahak-trained friends, because he was clearly a student of Altatahak, his muscles bulging beneath the fabric of his shirt.
"You seem nervous," Voss said. "Need a hand to hold?"
"I'm only nervous for your man," I said. "Keep your hand to yourself. I'm sure you'll need it later." Voss laughed.
"I guess you don't need me anymore, now that you've found someone else who can touch you."
"What's that supposed to mean?"
"You know exactly what I mean."
Voss's eyes glittered with anger.
"Better keep your eyes on your little Thuvazit pet. He's about to die."
Suzhou had struck first, lunging at Akos, who sidestepped the lazy move without batting an eye.
"Oh, you're quick,"
Suzhou said, his voice echoing through the amplifiers.
"Just like your sister. She almost got away from me, too. She'd almost opened the front door when I caught her."
He snatched at Akos's throat again and tried to lift him up to press him against the arena wall, but Akos brought the inside of his wrist to Suzhou's, hard, breaking the hold and slipping away. I could hear the rules of Elmatahak strategy, telling him to keep his distance from a larger opponent. Akos spun the knife once on his palm, the move dazzling with its speed. Light reflected off the blade, scattering across the floor, and Suzhou followed it with his eyes. Akos took advantage of the momentary distraction and punched him hard with his left hand. Suzhou stumbled back, blood streaming from his nostrils. He hadn't realized that Akos was left-handed, or that I had been making him do push-ups for as long as I had known him. Akos pursued him, bending his arm and thrusting him up with his elbow, hitting Suzhou again in the nose. Suzhou's yell echoed in the space. He lashed out blindly, grabbing the front of Akos's armor and hurling him sideways. Akos's balance faltered, and Suzhou pressed him to the ground with a knee and punched him hard in the jaw. I winced. Akos, looking dazed, pulled his knee up to his face like he was going to try to throw Suzhou off. Instead, he drew a knife from the side of his boot and drove the blade into Suzhou's side, right between two of his ribs. Suzhou, stunned, fell over, staring at the handle protruding from his side. Akos swiped with his other knife. There was a flash of red on Suzhou's throat when he collapsed. I hadn't even realized how tense I was until the fight was done and my muscles relaxed. All around me was noise. Akos bent over Suzhou's body and yanked his second knife free. He wiped the blade on his pants and sheathed it again in his boot. I could hear his shaking breaths amplified by the enhancers. "Don't panic," I thought toward him, like he could hear. He wiped sweat from his forehead with his sleeve and lifted his eyes to the people sitting around the arena. He turned in a slow circle, as if he was staring every one of them down. Then he sheathed his knife and stepped over Suzhou's body to walk down the aisle toward the exit. I waited a few seconds, then walked off the platform and into the crowd. My heavy clothes billowed away from my body as I went. I held up my skirts with both hands and tried to catch up to Akos, but he had too much of a lead. I didn't see him as I marched through the corridors toward our quarters. Once I reached the door, I paused with my hand near the sensor, listening. At first, all I heard were heavy breaths that turned into sobs. Then Akos screamed, and there was a loud crash, followed by another one. He screamed again, and I pressed my ear to the door to listen, my lower lip trapped between my teeth. I bit down so hard I tasted blood when Akos's screams turned to sobs.
I touched the sensor, opening the door. He was sitting on the floor in the bathroom. There were pieces of shattered